And William Henry is with me, and then we're going to take your phone calls this hour. So get ready on Coast to Coast Day Out. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, William Henry. William, when you go to Egypt, which will be what, your second trip?
Yes.
Ah, now what are you going to look for specifically?
Well, I've got more research to follow up on. I've been in contact with a recent Coast guest, Stephen Mailer, who has a really interesting body of research that he's putting together concerning this this particular hieroglyph called the Asgat-Nefer glyph, which means the harmony of water or beautiful waters. And you remember a moment ago when you asked about that that the possibility that the drawing that Sitchin presented is actually some kind of a weapon system, and I said
yes.
No, it's probably an ascension vehicle because of the pillar that's portrayed underground. Well, that pillar appears to be connected with the creation of these spiritual-type waters. And so I'm very interested in that subject right now because, of course, you know, there's a real Atlantean tie-in with the whole idea of the waters, of it being called the land of waters, and always looking for the myths and legends of those who work with this water, who cross this water, as did Elijah and Enoch, who of civilizations that are destroyed by water, because that that whole concept of water, especially spiritual water, is virtually unexplored right now.
Okay, let's go to the phones. Let's pick it up by going to First Time Caller Line. You're on Coast to Coast with William Henry. Hi there.
Hello, George and
yes,
William.
Sir.
My name's Charlie. I'm calling from Houston.
Mm.
A few moments ago, you were talking about the possibility of the Bermuda Triangle being a vortex. And I was
yes.
just wondering, if it were a vortex, could there also be other vortexes around the Earth, possibly opposite each other on the surface of the Earth? I'll take your answer off the air.
Okay.
It's certainly a possibility. I mean, as we discussed, there's at least one other major vortex area in the Great Lakes region, and so undoubtedly there's going to be others, but I haven't seen a map of where all the various planetary vortexes are located. Oh, that would be an interesting task for somebody to assemble.
Another one for you, William, would be to investigate Coral Castle.
Well, I've touched on that. I was really excited by Richard Hoagland's investigation into that. And I got a small library of Edley Scallon's books and started pouring through them. And the reason I was intrigued is because the imagery that he uses in his books, it's wormhole imagery. And it suggests that he, too, might have been clued into this this same primordial sacred science that we've been discussing this evening. So that's definitely something to follow up on. I'm planning a trip to Florida in January to investigate. I've got good friends down in the Naples-Fort Myers area, and I'm hoping to pop back down there and head over to Coral Castle at the same time.
Well, wouldn't it be something, though, if the secrets to all of this happens to be right under our nose? It's that easy?
Well, I mean, it appears that that's the case, and there are people that have a tendency to tap into it, and then the object is to learn how to embody that and put it into practical application, and that's where we're at right now.
All right, we'll pick it up by going to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You are on the air with us. Hi there.
Yes, is this for me?
Yes, sir. You've got it.
Okay, this is Floyd. I'm calling you from San Antonio, Texas. You know, it's WOAI land.
Absolutely. Number
and
one WOAI land. Go ahead.
Exactly. Well, to show you what a William Henry fan I am, I'm going to ask William to give us maybe 2 or 3 minutes of, I guess, what you'd call comic relief and have him tell again, like he did about 6 years ago on Coast to Coast, briefly the story of the one-footed snorkel monster.
Oh, boy, this is like a greatest hit show now.
What a memory.
No kidding.
Well, yeah, I recorded it for the first time about 6 years ago. I've played it probably 50 times since then.
Oh, incredible. Well, I guess I'd like to hear your version of the story then. No, I'm just kidding. This is an amazing story, George. It happened here in Tennessee, a little town called Cross Plains, Tennessee, of all place names, where the plains or fields cross. And what happened is there's a gentleman, I call him Larry Bird in the story just to protect his real name. He's awakened one night by what sounds like rain falling down on the roof of his trailer. And I know it sounds, you know, like a story because we're talking Tennessee and everybody thinks trailer parks, but this guy is literally awakened by, and there is a police report on this as well. The rain falls down on the roof of his trailer. He awakens, he looks outside, and he sees what he describes as a one-footed snorkel monster on his deck. This thing looks like an elephant's trunk, but it has a single bird's foot, and it's being fired upon by a UFO, he says, that was hovering just above a radio tower about a mile or two away.
What?
Yeah, and he describes this thing to the local TV and newspaper people as the one-footed snorkel monster, because that's what it looked like. And he said he got the sense the thing had been wounded, his dog had been fired upon by a laser beam shot from this UFO, and his dog was injured, trees were knocked down in his backyard, and his family, he woke them up because he was terrified, for one thing, for their safety, but he also wanted them to see what he was seeing so that when he told them about it later, they wouldn't think he was crazy. And so he watches this scenario unfold all night long. They wake up the next morning, and all appears to be calm. And his wife has a daylight sighting of this one-footed snorkel monster. She looks across the street and sees that the thing is spinning in place. The night before, they had seen it spin and turn into a ball of light that danced around his truck, underneath the truck, dancing throughout the yard. And how I got tipped onto this story is Larry Bird called my brother-in-law's brother and said, "You are not going to believe what happened to me, and your brother is the weirdest person I know. I need to talk with him." And he was being nice when he's calling him a weird person. He just needs someone that would understand what he was going through. And so my sister and brother-in-law took off immediately, went up there, and aided the family, gave them comfort, and also developed a tremendous sense of compassion for this being.
So they believed the story.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And in fact, my brother-in-law, Donnie, took a photograph of this thing's footprint. And I have that in my archives. And I'll put that article back up on my website. I took it down when I was...
How big was the print?
The print was about 3 inches. It was bigger than a chicken's footprint. But here's the thing, George. When you look throughout myth and in even scripture, you find example after example of creatures that match the one-footed snorkel monster. But the thing is that it is so arcane in these stories. They describe these serpents, which they call the serpents of wisdom, but they very often omit or conceal the detail that it has a single bird's foot. And so here we have in this amazing story from Cross Plains, Tennessee, what appears to be an appearance of this creature that appears throughout the ages. I'll give you an example. In ancient Egypt, in the Edfu text, they describe this one-footed snorkel monster type creature, a one-footed serpent that is attacked by the Great Pyramid. The Great Pyramid sends out a sound wave in order to attack or repel this creature. It's absolutely amazing, amazing tales that are told around this creature.
How does this thing balance itself?
I have no idea. But what I'm thinking, it's just some kind of an anomalous creature. And as my research developed on it, I began to wonder when you see it in alchemical texts where they'll show, for example, a jar or some form of a grail with this serpent figure emerging from it. And we actually will see human beings that are entering into or exiting from this serpent creature, this snorkel monster. And as I began to accumulate a repetition of this imagery, I began to wonder, is this creature like some kind of a wormhole itself? is this why it's tube-shaped in this way? And why we see human beings entering into and exiting from it? It's not consuming them as if it's eating humans for food. Rather, it appears to function as some form of a conduit.
Who named it a one-footed snorkel monster?
Gentleman I call Larry Bird.
He did. Okay. Not
it.
You.
No, not me. He didn't know what it was, so he just called it a one-footed snorkel monster because it had one bird's foot and it looked like an elephant's trunk, but it was green.
I would like to see this picture, this illustration.
I'll send it to you. I'll be happy
okay.
to do that. And
absolutely.
I'll send you the police report, too.
Send it to Lex, too. Maybe you can post it in his recap with you.
Great idea. I'll do that.
All right, let's go next to our West of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello, Mr. Norrie.
Yes, sir. Hi.
Hi, my name's Chris. I'm from Tucson, Arizona.
Hello, Chris. It's all yours. Go ahead.
Hello, Mr. Henry. Hi. Hi. I just wanted to ask you two quick things. What's your thought of the parallel universe and paradoxes in relation to time travel? And if you don't mind, before you get to that, Mr. Norrie,
yeah.
About 2 months ago, you had a gentleman on the show that you're doing some kind of ESP thing. I guess he was in Virginia and you were in your station, and I guess you thought of a pyramid and you thought of a house. I thought of a house too.
Yeah, that was I think that was Lionel Fanthorpe.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'll go ahead and let Mr. Henry take the question.
Okay.
And
very
I'll
good.
Get off there and I'll listen to it.
William, what do you think of parallel universes and time travel?
Well, I think it's really possible, and while we're on the greatest hits subject here, I remember we were talking a few years ago about my book, Cloak of the Illuminati, and I was
yes.
describing the new nanotechnology super soldier suit that's being created by MIT for the military, and how Dana Augustine had, when he was doing the artwork for the cover of that book, said, wow, this capability of this suit that has a charge in its heel where the soldier can jump over a house if he needs to, that sounds like Spring-Heeled Jack. And I had no idea who Spring-Heeled Jack was, but you might remember we had talked about that. And
yeah.
This is a story from England where this figure had this suit that he wore that made him, he was resistant to ballistic attack. He couldn't, if he was shot, the bullet pinged off and he could jump over houses. And I mentioned that.
And he had like a hook or something for hands.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the last appearance of Spring-Heeled Jack was in London, and he gathered a bunch of people to a house and he disappeared over the house. And the name of the street was William Henry Street.
I love it.
Yeah. And yeah. I just always say, well, yeah, I wonder if, you know, that's like a time traveler that suddenly led me to this street here and saying, okay, you're on the right track. Keep pursuing this suit. Because as you look into these stories of the beings that come and go through these gateways, there is always a power garment that they are wearing preparatory to that experience. And here's a classic example of that garment or an initial step towards the creation of this super suit that transforms an ordinary human into a superhuman.
Do evil creatures, entities, call them what you may, come through these portals, these stargates? Have they ever hurt somebody physically?
I don't have any data on that, George. My sense is that, again, from the examples that I've been studying, it requires a ring or a vibration, as I described it earlier, as the ring of cosmic sovereignty. That's pure love. That is pure love is what is required. And it suggests to me that a being of evil is going to be a fear-based being and therefore would not be able to access these portals.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
Good evening.
Yeah.
George and William.
We are here for you.
Thank you. This is Mike. I'm calling in Strongsville, Ohio tonight with my friend.
Okay. Sure.
William, since you mentioned the pituitary gland's excretions revealing possible secret knowledge, that spot between our eyes, marked with a red dot in India, sometimes referred as our point of existence, interesting test. Dr. Strassman, he was the only person allowed to do a clinical study that compound DMT, which is naturally occurring from our pituitary gland. And Dr. Strassman said that volunteers on the highest doses reported meeting and communicating with extraterrestrial entities. And could this be a possible mechanism for change in mass consciousness via either the sun's activity or Paul of Violet's cosmic wave?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a very great question, Mike, because it suggests that we have this mechanism built within that is capable of receiving, through a process of resonance, very tiny electromagnetic frequencies that can, in fact, release these secretions. And that's the whole shooting match for me right there, is finding the way to open up that oyster, because it transforms us into a being of tremendous spiritual capability, and also ultimately a being of ultimate love. And that's what this is all about.
I'm still trying to find out more information on this one-footed snorkel monster you talked about. You ever mention that critter at your speaking engagements?
I have, yes. And it's a favorite of many of the people in my audiences. And in fact, there is more to the story, I've been told, by Larry Bird. And perhaps now is the time to reconnect with him to get the second half. He was not wanting to reveal additional facts about what happened that night, just because he was concerned that nobody would believe him. I mean, we're talking about a ordinary type of a person here that is not interested in these subjects, that found himself witness to this astonishing display of, a cosmic encounter. Just amazing.
Could this have been Mothman?
You know what, George? I can't believe you said that, because I don't usually go to psychics, but I did have an opportunity to get a reading once several years ago, shortly after working on this story, and he said, "Your research is directly related to Mothman." And I'm like, "What are you talking about? My research has nothing to do with Mothman." And it turns out that it does. That there is this connection between Mothman and the snorkel monster, and that's something I'm still having to kind of follow up on, and I'll be happy to report on it as soon as I've got some additional data.
Apparently, Mothman always shows up before major Earth-wide calamities or catastrophes, and I find that alone to be pretty fascinating. You know, comes before wars, comes before disasters. I don't know if he is a warning device, it is a warning device, or if it helps cause some of them. I just don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. But the snorkel monster had the feeling, according to Larry Bird, of being, it was being pursued by who was operating the UFO hovering above the radio tower. And he had a sense that it had escaped from some kind of an extraterrestrial zoo or something.
Probably one of those Star Wars bars.
Maybe.
You never know. Well, stay with us. William Henry, our guest. His website, williamhenry.net. We'll finish up the program by taking the rest of your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, I wanted to do something a little different this time. I was chatting with my producers last week, and they were tossing some guest ideas at me, and I went, nope, I don't want that. Nope. Don't want him. Nope. And so I said, well, what about this? So they went to work, and what we will have for you tomorrow will be a potpourri of guests. Each half hour, a special Coast to Coast guest with their own particular expertise. So it's almost as if you're going to get five shows in one. So sit back and enjoy that. That'll be on our next Coast to Coast program. When we come right back, it'll be the rest of your phone calls and William Henry on Coast to Coast AM. Well, you know, I'm getting a lot of fast blasts from people who want to know a little bit more about the Stargate tours in Nashville.
Oh, cool.
What is that?
Well, the drawing that we looked at of the second century particle accelerator.
Right.
That came out of my research that I had done on FDR's quest for the Holy Grail in Mongolia in 1934. He, along with his two-term Secretary of Agriculture, Henry A. Wallace, and Nicholas Rurik, a Russian mystic, reformed the archetypal trio of the three wise men looking for the reincarnated Jesus as well as the secrets of the Holy Grail. There was a series of letters that were written by Henry Wallace to Nicholas Rurik during the course of that expedition and the preamble to it. One of those letters clearly indicated that they were searching for the Holy Grail without question, but it also gave some coordinates. And the coordinates that he gave in the letter referred to the place where they were going to return these secrets. The place was Nashville, Tennessee. And what I found as I was looking around Nashville for any kind of evidence that the result of this quest may have turned up in Nashville led me to a place called the Tennessee Bicentennial Capitol Mall, which is a 2,200-foot-long rod, magician's rod, that is laid out on 19 acres, maybe even 19.5 acres, hi, Richard, at the base of the Tennessee State Capitol. This magician's rod is a virtual carbon copy of the second century particle accelerator drawing.
So the quest for this, the drawing that you know you've shown us that
yeah.
we have on the website,
mm-hmm.
Was an illustration. However, it was based on something real then, right?
Yes, I believe it was. And what we have here in Nashville now is a living temple that is this rod laid out on the ground. If you go to my website, I have a link on the front page called Stargate Park. And I have a side-by-side, a comparison of the second century Meru drawing with a line drawing of the Bicentennial Capitol Mall. And we can see that we are talking about the same type of technology.
All right, let's go to the phones.
Okay.
First time caller line, you're on the air with William Henry on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hello, Mr. Henry. This is Ed. I'm in Los Angeles.
Hello, Ed.
A few minutes ago, I tuned into the show late, and I believe I heard Mr. Henry saying that he wished we could understand the human body well enough to know how to direct its energies so that we could activate the pineal gland and come into this great gift of cosmic consciousness. If I did understand you correctly, sir, I just wanted to make sure you understood that these techniques, insofar as they are meditative and meditational, have been known for thousands of years, even though they are not broadcast like through through a newspaper or a radio show. They are found in the occult study of the Kabbalah, the secret wisdom of Israel. My teachers tell me that we can trace the Kabbalah back through history more than 5,000 years. Basically, the techniques are meditative, and they raise the kundalini up one stage at a time into the brain, and when it activates the pineal gland, the granular material there crystallizes into what is otherwise known as the philosopher's stone. And it is then that that organ provides us with access to a sensibility without restriction and limitation, a wholeness and a universality within ourselves and a union with the universe and God.
Well spoken, Ed. And in fact, during our first hour, George and I were talking about some Templar graffiti at Dom, France, that portrayed exactly the Sephirotic tree of life, the Kabbalistic tree, and indicates that the Templars likely were using these principles at that time in the 13th century. And I cited that as one clear example of this group accessing this knowledge. And you're absolutely right. This knowledge is known, but it is not widely taught. It's the type of thing that when the student is ready, the teachers appear. And perhaps now is becoming a time when more and more students are going to be ready. And here come the teachers.
Thanks for that question. Thanks for the response also, William. East of the Rockies, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, good evening. My question is, why do you suppose that entities who are so advanced and powerful and operating so openly in ancient times, even after the fall of Atlantis, would then suddenly sort of cut humanity off from knowledge of their existence at a certain point and leave us, you know, in rational materialism or sort of, you know, watered down versions of Shinarian religion and sort of leave us groping? You know, what do you suppose was, what do you suppose that seems to have happened, if you?
Well, I think getting back to our earlier discussion about our relationship with the galactic center, you know, various traditions talk about the 26,000-year cosmic journey called the precession of the equinoxes that our sun and solar system make around the galactic center. And it appears that, well, according to these various traditions, we go through intermittent periods of light and darkness. It's the modus operandi of the gods is build it to destroy it to build it again. And that seems to be the cyclic nature of all of nature. And it's a perfectly natural process. And right now, we happen to be in one of the heightened stages of that process where we're beginning to experience climate change, consciousness change, and this is, as I referred to earlier, the golden moment when we have an opportunity to really embrace an age of light and emerge from the darkness.
Okay, well, thank you. I thought he was going to come back with his follow-up question, and he said nothing. Let's go to our wild card line. It's your turn. You're on with William Henry. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, William.
Hello to you.
I am calling from near Nashville, from Murfreesboro, William.
Oh, very nice.
And I just have to thank you, and I am deeply grateful for the knowledge that you are sharing with all of us, and it is obvious to me that you are coming from a place of genuine and sincere love, and that just really permeates through everything you say.
Well, thank you very much.
So a couple of questions. One is, you seem to have a lot of knowledge about the meaning of names of things or words. Where are you getting that knowledge is the first question.
Oh, well, it's a constant search. I mean, I try to zero in on certain key words, Atlantis, Tula, Meru, and look for their repetition throughout the ages and just spend my time trying to accumulate the meanings of these words in various cultures.
Okay. And then the second question is, do you believe that Jesus had some type of an extraterrestrial connection?
Well, I think without question, especially we've referenced the hypostasis of the archons this evening. I've got my new book, The Illuminator, coming out about Mary Magdalene, and that is the entire premise of the Gnostic Christian tradition, is that he was in contact with other beings and, in fact, taught various disciples how to communicate with them. That's one of the primary principles of the Gnostic Christian tradition, is that there are these beings, you can learn their language, you can learn the secrets of the heavens. In fact, that is a large part of our earthly existence, is to accumulate such knowledge. So to answer your question directly, yes, I do believe that he was in direct contact with these beings. And of course, the traditional Christian church focuses on his encounter with one being in particular, which they call Satan, who is presented as a tempter in the traditional Christian tradition, but may have another role to play as an enlightener type being called Lucifer in other traditions.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, too. You know, the conflict between good and evil and Satan and Jesus has always fascinated me. I'm wondering, though, if there's a bigger picture to that, William, that we really haven't been taught yet or pointed out. I mean, there just seems to be a relationship, a closeness between this good and evil that I find strange.
Oh, without question, George. And that's, again, one of the opportunities of our times, I feel. You know, in the past, we talk about Satan taking Jesus up to the high mountain and tempting him, saying, hey, this can all be yours. And we're asked to consider that where he took him to was the pinnacle of Solomon's temple in Jerusalem, Well, what if instead he took him up to the Hubble Space Telescope and downloaded a couple images and said, look, all of this can be yours. All the hundreds of billions of galaxies that are out there, isn't that in fact the kingdom that we're really talking about? And that is what brings about the awakening to me, is taking our position, our perspective away from a dot of real estate on Earth and saying what we really want to focus on and tune our consciousness into is the greater universe out there, the enormous garden of galaxies that we now know is our natural habitat.
Next up is our wild card line. It's your turn. Hi there.
George, is that me?
Yes, sir. Hi.
Fantastic. Good to talk to both of you. I'm really honored. I wanted to say, first of all, to William Henry, in my search for my own truth, I inadvertently stumbled across the language of the birds, and my eyes have been really open ever since.
Good for you.
Remarkable thing. William, I'd like to ask, on your last show, I think it was, you asked about, or you talked about an image that a Napoleon, one of his savants, made a rubbing of a bas-relief in Egypt of...
Yes.
I think you called it the Mandelion?
Yes.
What was that figure known as in Egypt? What was the name in that place?
The name of that figure in Egypt was Serapis, who was a combined god, a combination of Osiris and Api, which was a bull god who was featured as a serpent. And the image to which the gentleman refers was a rubbing made in 1798 by a savant in Napoleon's army that shows the exact face on the face of the Shroud of Turin, only it's on the body of a serpent. And the kind of amazing thing about it is that this rubbing was made 100 years before the first photograph was made of the Shroud of Turin, revealing the holy face to the world, allegedly for the first time. And what this shows is that there are, in fact, two examples of this exact face, one on the Shroud of Turin, one on this rubbing made by Napoleon's, the savant Napoleon's army, that is today in the Louvre.
Oh, great. Thank you. I've been waiting for months to ask you that. And also, I was watching on one of the TV learning channels. I'm sorry, I don't remember which one. But they showed a picture of another drawing or possibly a bas-relief in Egypt. It looked just like Alfred E. Newman from Mad Magazine. Do you have any idea what that is?
No idea, but I show in my presentations from other temple sites. Remember the worms from Men in Black?
Uh-huh.
You see them on the temple walls, too. You see these reptilian guys that look, they're exactly like the worms. I mean, the guys from Men in Black must have seen these guys on the temple walls in Egypt. They're hilarious.
All right, well, that's enough for my mind tonight. I sure appreciate both of you for what you do. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you for your call. What do you think of the etching on that plaque, whatever it might be, from Abydos, Egypt, that looks like a helicopter in ships and flying machines?
Well, I've been told that that's actually a mistake. The explanation for that is that they had done some repairs on some of the hieroglyphs there, and it only looks or appears like it's a helicopter, but in fact, I guess it's really not. But when you go there and you actually look at it, it sure does look like a helicopter. So the jury's still kind of out on that one, I think.
Let's pop west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, William.
Hi there.
Great to be on tonight. I'm Bill from Washington State, listening on 1470 KELA.
Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I love your show. I listen often. My question tonight, because I'm Cherokee descent, is, what was the name of the book that you mentioned earlier on? I didn't quite catch it. And the Cherokee woman that you spoke of, could you spell her name?
Certainly. The title of the book is Voices of Our Ancestors. The author's name is Dhyani Wehu, and I'll spell that. It's Dhyani Wehu, Wahoo.
Give us another recap of the book, will you?
Well, this is Cherokee teachings that she has assimilated or brought together that go back 27 generations. And she is a member of the traditional Etowah band of the Cherokee, which has lived in Georgia and East Tennessee over here. And she was trained from the time she was very young in the ancestral wisdom of her lineage, and then later was charged with the duty to put this in a book and bring these teachings forward that, again, had been secret until 1969, coincidentally the same year we landed on the moon.
Wow, that's great. Thank you very much. Can you tell us a little bit more about this 12th gate of energy?
Well, these 12 gates of energy are really interesting because Plato had said that if you could see the true Earth from afar, it would appear as a 12-angled pyramid. Then the Egyptians also had this idea, only they said that at each of the apexes of the 12 points are holes in space that are guarded by some kind of a serpent. And what I've been wondering is if we're talking about some kind of a natural energy gateway that surrounds our planet,
mm-hmm.
and if in fact these are the gates that are referred to as the 12 gates of the New Jerusalem, for example. Interestingly, science has come up with the notion that the universe itself is roughly shaped like a 12-angled pyramid or a dodecahedron. So it appears that this is some very important sacred geometry that we have to more fully understand.
Okay, thanks for that question. Let's move on next to our wildcard line real quickly. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Marcy. I'm calling from Troy, New York.
Sure thing, Marcy.
I got a few questions real quick. One, I hear you guys mentioning a lot about the Philosopher's Stone. I was wondering what exactly that is. Two, what was the first evidence as far as Atlantis that they were of a higher, that they were, you know, highly technology and all that? And three, this supersuit you were mentioning before, what was that about?
And I'll let you knock them out in 30 seconds, William. The Philosopher's Stone
is removing the interval, the lag time between thought and action so that you have instant materialization of wishes. And the idea that Atlantis has left us an advanced technology comes from many traditions. I mean, just look at the Great Pyramids as one example of a hypothesis of advanced Atlantean technology. And you look at the Osirian, which is beside the Temple of Abydos, where you referred the helicopter as being located. These ancient temples were devised by beings that had machinery and milling capabilities that we're scarcely matching today. And that's a key example right there, especially the Osirian, of ancient temple complexes that embody this and portray this in imagery.
All right, William. Let's go to williamhenry.net. Thanks, William. Appreciate you being on the show.
Thank you so much, George. I really appreciate the conversation.
When we come back on our next Coast to Coast show, it'll be the first day of fall. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDessour, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.